Hi, this is Paul. This is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current status of my Sunday sermon. Jesus is commonly known today as a wise teacher, someone who exemplifies moral behavior and wisdom. But many people, if they actually read the Gospels, and especially the Sermon on the Mount, which is arguably one of the most famous pieces of teaching that is attributed to Jesus, they might seriously wonder about him. The admonitions from the Sermon on the Mount are remarkably unnatural in terms of our distinctive behavior. Just go through the sermon and take a look at it. The Beatitudes are often looked at as some precious jewel of insight and teaching, but I sometimes wonder if people don't stop and read them. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth, when the truth is the meek usually get nothing. The meek usually get stepped on. The meek usually get left behind. The words that we use for the meek are often doormats. That's what being meek gets you almost all the time. We value people who stand up for themselves, who raise their fist in the air against others, who demand their rights, who aren't going to wait anymore. They're tired and they won't take it anymore. That's who we value. That's who we say changes the world for the better, not the meek. Blessed are you when others revile you. We are so defensive, we stand up and speak our mind, and it even bothers us if someone is thinking less of us. And we demand that they think of us in better terms. And we're just fearful that somewhere in the world, someone is having an unkind or a less than equal thought of us, and we're there to make them stop thinking that way. Or at least make them stop whatever they're doing that makes us think they're thinking that way. Jesus talks about murder. Yeah, everyone will say murder is wrong, but calling your enemy you fool? Well, that's just accountability. Or sure, adultery is wrong. That kind of cheating is wrong, but lust? That seems unreasonable to have something against that. Divorce? Well, today I see people arguing that, well, it's the two-parent household that's the source of all our misery, and it would be better if we just destroyed monogamy completely and let people sort of do what they want. What do I mean, let them do what they want? They do what they want. There's no law against sleeping around. But divorce? You know, stay with that partner? Turn the other cheek? No, the only way you make the world better is if you hit them first, or at least make them think you'll hit them harder, so harder if they even say anything against you. The spirit of Lamech, if you remember anything from the early chapters of Genesis, that's the spirit in which we trust. Love your enemies, pray for them, and pray that God smite them. That's usually what we think. Give, pray, and deny yourself in secret. We want the whole world to know just how righteous we are. We want our virtue signal so that everybody knows our virtue. We jealously guard our reputation because we're afraid someone might think ill of us. Don't do your heaping up of money, security, reputation on earth where it's useful. But in heaven? Who believes that anymore? It's amazing. People out there say, well, Jesus was wise, and I most often think they've never even looked at what he teaches. And this isn't new. And one of my favorite illustrations comes from Virginia Stem Owens, who wrote a piece in the Reformed Journal in 1987, where she, as an English professor at Texas A&M, in the 80s, in the middle of the Bible Belt, simply handed her students out a copy of the Sermon on the Mount. Just here's a copy, read it, and write an essay about what you think of it. Students hated it. The Beatitudes, well, they're simply irreligious and nonsensical. Jesus' treatment of the law is way overboard. Not displaying statusable moral behavior? What is my Instagram feed for? They didn't have Instagram in the 1980s. We're aspiring world changers, but Jesus is the most successful world changer the world has ever seen. He never ruled a country. He never led an army. He never even wrote a book. He poured 3 years into 12 disciples who, by the end of the story, didn't seem to have much of a clue about what he was saying or what he was doing. And he was hated enough by both sides in a vicious culture war that he was brutally executed by one side giving him up to the other. And neither could find a good excuse not to kill him in the most barbaric, mocking, exposed way possible. That's the story. And this is our world changer. And then he turns and says, well, now it's your turn. Well, what do you mean it's my turn? I'm just one little person. Yeah, that's right. Where do you start? Well, his disciples were 11. One of them turned him over and sold him for 30 pieces of silver. The disciples started right away. Well, how do we start? Not with some government. Start with ourselves. Well, what does that mean? In our homes, in our relationships, in our workplaces, in our lives around us. Start by doing what Jesus tells us to do. That's what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. Well, and we have all these tricks and we imagine all these ways that this must be, but if you've been following along in the Sermon on the Mount, it's all these very unnatural things to do. And it's not just all these little simplistic things. In almost every situation, you have to think it through and ask yourself, what was Jesus really teaching and how should I apply it in this moment, in this time, in this place, in what way? He continues, do not judge, or you too will be judged. Now, this word judge is a very broad word. I think probably the better translation is, do not condemn, do not damn, or you too will be damned. I think that's a pretty good definition. I think that's a pretty good translation of it. For in the same way you condemn others, you will be condemned. Isn't that exactly what you see on social media? Go out there in Twitter and Facebook land and condemn someone and go back. He's exactly right. Long before social media came about. And you will be condemned, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Because what was new and fresh in Jesus' day, talking about hypocrisy, that's simply become the standard today. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? In other words, we're looking around and we're finding fault with everyone, and our lives are full of faults. A speck of sawdust, the tiniest little bit of that whole board, and the board is in our eye. How can you say to your brother, let me take that speck out of your eye, when all the time you have a plank in your own and you're looking for that tiny little piece of sawdust? How many specks of sawdust are there in one plank? You hypocrite! Jesus is doing it to us. First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. And then verse 6. And verse 6 seems to change the subject, but what verse 6 actually does is up the resolution on verses 1 through 5. Do not give dogs what is sacred, and do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they will trample on them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. And again, that's pretty much what happens on social media. Well, now, they didn't have a very high view of dogs back then, and if you've lived in the third world today, you have a pretty good idea of what third world dogs look like. But he's basically saying, don't give to a dog what a dog can't understand or respect or appreciate. And so what verse 6 is actually saying is, you do have to use discernment. You do have to use discretion. You must be armed with these things. Well, then what does he mean by verse 1? Do not condemn, do not damn, or you too will be damned. So what does that mean? Well, he's asking you to use your head. In fact, the book of James says things pretty much what Jesus is saying here. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You desire but do not have, so you kill, or you mock. You covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. That's pretty much what we do. Same in the first century as us today. When you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives. That you spend what you get, you ask with wrong motives, that you spend what you get on your own pleasures. In other words, even the way you're asking and what you're asking for betrays you're just kind of selfish in what you want. Brothers and sisters, do not slander one another. Anyone who speaks against a brother or sister judges them or condemns them, speaks against the law and condemns it. When you condemn the law, you are not keeping it, but you're sitting in judgment on it. There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and destroy. But you, who are you to condemn or judge your neighbor? Just this week, someone sent me a couple of pictures of Calvin and Hobbes cartoons, and I was amazed that they were exactly what I was making my sermon about. So little Calvin, and of course, is the tiger Hobbes. I hope I got them right. I'm pretty sure I got them right. Doesn't it seem like, this is little Calvin, doesn't it seem like everybody just shouts at each other nowadays? I don't know when this comic was done. Seems awfully fresh. I think it's because conflict is drama. Drama is entertaining, and entertainment is marketable. Social media, reality TV, it's very marketable. Finding consensus and common ground is dull. Nobody wants to watch a civilized discussion that acknowledges ambiguity and complexity. We want to see fireworks. We want the sense of solidarity and identity that comes with having our interests narrowly. Well, that's a little from having our interests narrowed and exploited by like-minded zealots. Talk show hosts, political candidates, news programs, special interest groups. Maybe this was before social media. They all become successful by reducing debates to the level of shouting rage. Nothing gets solved, but we're all entertained. Hobbes says, you might be right. And then there's a long pause. And Calvin says, what a boring day this turned out to be. No conflict. Another one. I'm writing a fundraising letter. The secret to getting donations is to depict everyone who disagrees with you as the enemy. Then you can explain they're systematically working to destroy everything you hold dear. It's a war of values. Rational discussion is hopeless. Compromise is unthinkable. Our only hope is a well-founded antagonism. So we need your money to keep up the fight. Pretty much every donation request. Not every, but certainly a lot of them. How cynically unconstructive, says Hobbes. Calvin says, enmity sells. Just couple of weeks ago, saw this article on the internet calling social media the internet of beefs, divided the world into mooks and knights on the internet. Mooks are an army of social media users who perpetuate the conflict hoping to be seen by the knights. The knights are the celebrities, major or minor, who deploy the mooks and earn from them. And the knights are just as much enslaved by the mooks. There go my mooks. I must find out where they are going so I can get out in front of them and lead them. Find the crowd. Get out in front. Declare yourself the leader. And people will follow you because they're already going that way. No one wants to resolve anything because the drama and the money go together. And if the drama stops, the money stops. And they're all miserable doing it. How do you step out of the economy of beefs? We say to ourselves, well, if I stop using shame and condemnation, then they get away with it. Is your shame and condemnation stopping them at all? They aren't, you know, can't you see that in many ways this whole game of conflict pays? It pays for the media, it pays for the television, it pays for the internet. It's sort of like the drunk's wife who thinks she's stopping his drinking by hiding the bottles. What she needs is a good trip to Al-Anon, where they will tell her, you're not doing him any favors, really. You're nagging? Your nagging is probably more about your own self-righteousness than his drinking. This is really about our attempt to save the world. We think that nagging will somehow turn people around. Well, we really believe that the noisy nag in our heads is doing something to fix things. How does your noisy nag work? Mine just bothers me more than anything else. Maybe now and then I'll listen to it, but that's all with inside me. I don't get as defensive against myself as we all get defensive against each other. Jesus tells us, do not be anxious. Seek first the kingdom and his righteousness. I mean, someone might hold up a mirror to me right now and say, well, will the preacher nagging you about nagging get you to stop? Well, no. I've been preaching long enough that everybody seems to often say, oh, pastor, that sermon was convicting. But did the sermon actually change much of your behavior? Usually not from nagging. Now, Jesus tells us this, but I think he knows quite well we're not going to listen. And Jesus, in fact, does miracles, but when he gets arrested and put on a cross, his disciples run and hide as if, well, somehow he doesn't have the power from the cross that he had when he stilled the storm or healed the sick or raised the dead. Why does Jesus allow this to happen to himself? He lets himself become our victim. Why? Because it's usually at that point we say, now I'll stop them. And then we take their life. And we are exposed to be what we are. We see the blood on our hands. We see ourselves not as saviors, but as perpetrators, which is exactly what we are. And maybe, just maybe, we start looking for a better savior. One who can save us, not from those other enemies that we're constantly denouncing and judging and condemning and thinking that all of the shame we're heaping on them will stop them, when in fact all it does is make them do the same back to us. When we realize we need to be saved from ourselves. By someone who loves us enough to die in our place. Our lives, our world, has become unmanageable. And we believe a power greater than ourselves can restore this world to sanity. That's the first step. And some of you say, well, I've heard that before. Yeah, you have. You see, the truth is we must discern. That's the whole pearls before swine thing. We must discern. And one of the first things we should discern is the nagging and the judging and the condemning don't stop anything. So we should check our tongues. And we should wait for those moments of opportunity where just maybe, probably a gentle word or an enlightening word might add a little bit of light. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. Answer a fool according to his folly is a verse twice in the book of Proverbs. Right there in the book of Proverbs, two Proverbs that seem to be saying the exact opposite thing. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you yourself will be just like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes. Well, which to do? Well, pearls before swine. Use discernment. Try and figure out, in fact, when to respond, when not to respond. But pastor, you're supposed to make it clear. You're supposed to give me one rule that fits in every situation. Am I? Can I? We wait for moments of opportunity, not to condemn, but to break through the cloud of self-righteousness in which we nurse our grudges. And it's the grudges and the resentments that often trap us. And I think the question of the drunk and his spouse or her spouse is helpful in this, because there's a lot of wisdom in those 12 steps, and they apply to the alcoholic, and they apply to those of us who maybe alcohol isn't the thing we stumble with. And I thought I would simply read them. We admitted that we are powerless over, you can fill in your blank. What is it that you are powerless over when you're on social media, when you're in that fight with your spouse, when you're talking to that boss, who is a real problem? That our lives have become unmanageable. We came to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn over our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. Made a searching and fearful moral inventory of ourselves, hypocrites though we are. Admitted to God, ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. We're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. That's a big one. Humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Make a list of all persons we have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such persons wherever possible, except where to do so would injure them or others. Why that one? Because we're really tricky this way. Self-righteousness seeps in. And I was just taking the high road. Oh, really? Were you really? Did you want your righteousness to be seen? You find that we are terribly tricky and deceptive at these things. Continue to take a personal inventory, and when we are wrong, promptly admit it. You don't find a lot of that on social media. You find very little, in fact. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us. Lord, I want you to know. I want them to know the truth. Okay, well, that's awfully generous of you, but let's start here. And the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others carefully and to practice these principles in all our affairs. It's not just alcohol. Judge not that you be not judged. Damn not that you be not damned.